The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Fabulous things, definitely awesome. So thank you for being here. Thank you for sticking it out and getting into this very last workshop. Well, maybe we'll hit the home run, bring it home for us. So I want to start by asking you some questions about what you do. So are you all in a grammar school? Are you in secondary grammar school, everybody? Okay, so let's think about the things that you do in a grammar school, and then I'd like for you to think about where you would place these. So we're thinking about overarching seven liberal arts and the trivium and the quadrivium. So for instance, just in your mind, where would you place Latin? Or where would you place a poem recitation? Or arts? Or music? Or science? Or instrumental music instruction? Can you hear me all right? Am I too okay? So would any of you place any of those items in the quadrivium? Would any of you regard them all as trivium subjects because you're in the grammar school? Is there such a thing as quadrivium subjects in the grammar school? You're so responsive. Yeah? Okay. So if these are typically considered trivium subjects, when do they become, or some of them, become quadrivium subjects? Do they switch over at some point in the high school, or do you have to wait till college to get into the quadrivium, and does it have to be a liberal arts college? And does it matter? Are they important? Is it something that we need, or where do these things fit in? So these were some of the things that have been on my mind for the last couple of years. And so I've just been thinking about the quadrivium and where its place is in the liberal arts and whether or not it fits in with the grammar school. So I became really fully convinced that the quadrivium actually does exist. And I think that it runs in conjunction with the trivium to some extent, and that it's an essential part of a liberal arts education, not only for the practicality that it brings, but also for the way that it educates our students in truth, beauty, and goodness, and brings them to a fully formed, virtuous adult. And I really think that by ignoring this piece of the quadrivium that we've left lay, more than half of the tools that we could be using in the formation of virtuous humans. So we're going to explore this idea using three words. We're going to use mend, muse, and method. So let me just start here by telling you a little bit about myself. My name's Jean Oxer. I've been teaching at a classical school for 13 years. And I taught before that, and I homeschooled before that. And I started at FCA, at Faith Christian Academy in Kansas City, Missouri, in their inaugural year of their grammar school. So they started with a high school, and the second year they added an elementary, and I came on as a kindergarten teacher. And I taught kindergarten for 5 years, and then I moved into third grade, and I've just finished my eighth year in third grade. And then a couple years back, I also took on the responsibilities of being the dean of faculty. So as you can imagine, it's a lot to do two full-time jobs, but you all probably do the same thing. So next year I'm moving into a seventh grade humanities block and then doing the the other responsibilities and adding curriculum development on top of all that, you know, in my spare time. So about 4 or 5 years prior to that, I really got agitated with trying to understand what a genuine classical education was. What was it historically, and what was I doing that was right, or this, it just didn't make sense? There were just some things that really irritated me. So I started to think, not like in an angry way, but just I just couldn't figure out some of the things that we were doing and why we were doing them. So I started asking these questions about what is an essential aspect of a classical education and what isn't essential. So, for instance, I was thinking, did I have to teach Greece and Rome in the third grade? What if I taught American history in the third grade? Would that be okay? What if I didn't teach Latin in the third grade? What if it came up in the eighth grade? Or what if you taught it in kindergarten? Would you be more classical if you did that? Or who made the decisions about whether this curriculum was classical and that, or that curriculum was classical? And did it have to have a pillar on the front of it? And who put that pillar there, and how did they know, and did I have to sing and chant everything? Did I just have to work on memorization? Did it have to be vast amounts of memorization? Did it matter what I was memorizing? And if I was memorizing a lot of things, is that what the classical education, the ancient classical educators were doing? So those are some of the things that I just really couldn't figure out. And then I just didn't understand why we couldn't talk about the quadrivium. So that started me really on this path of just reading and researching and everything I could get my hands on to understand what an ancient classical education was. So when we're talking today, I'm thinking about beyond this past 25 years in this current classical movement, and beyond the Sayers essay, back into the ancient world of what they were doing classically and what the seven liberal arts were and why they used them. So just to define some of those terms, the seven liberal arts, and I know that you know those, but just to be clear. So the seven liberal arts are divided into two sections, the trivium, which is the language arts, and the quadrivium, which are the mathematical arts. So the language arts are composed of three subjects, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and the mathematical arts of four subjects, arithmetic, geometry, math, and astronomy. So historically, the trivium was everything that they needed to learn and master in order to have a great grasp of a written and spoken language. So if I refer today to grammar, I'm not referring it in the terms of what a Sayers essay would do with a stage, but the art of grammar and the language arts, in the liberal arts, language arts section, means everything that helped a student master their language. So phonemic awareness and phonics and spelling rules and learning how to read and learning how to write and parts of speech, you know, grammar. So, and logic and rhetoric as subjects. And then on the mathematical side, there's arithmetic, which is the study of number, and geometry, which is the study of number in space or dimension, and then music, which is the study of number in time, and then astronomy, which is the study of number in time and space. So those seven comprise the liberal arts. So here's kind of a messy way that I see all this happening at the same time. And this is like not the most perfect diagram, but as you'll see, the on the far side where we've got the grade schools from kindergarten to 5 or 6 or whatever it is, and the black lines are far apart and they come closer together as I go through the grades. What I'm trying to show there is that in those early years in a grammar school, the most time in formal instruction is spent on the arts of grammar and arithmetic, grammar being grammar. So teaching reading, teaching writing skills, all those kind of things, and learning arithmetic. Reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? And reading and writing are both grammar. And the amount of formal instruction begins to decrease as they go into the high school years. Not that it has ended, but they don't spend all day teaching their kids how to read or to write a sentence or to hold their pencil correctly or those kind of things. And arithmetic, likewise, takes up a vast amount of formal instruction time in the early years and begins to decrease, although it never really ends. And my arrows would indicate that they end, but they really don't. And then on the other hand, we've got these the orange and the blue lines indicating music, geometry, science, and rhetoric, and then logic, just going the other direction. So very little formal instruction in the early years of those subjects, but a great amount of formal instruction time in the older years as they go through these subjects. So what do I mean by rhetoric in the younger years? Well, when in kindergarten, when the kids bring in their show and tell and they have to present it in front of their peers, they're learning the very early skills of speaking in front of people. In the third grade, then when we were giving book reports or presenting projects and I was asking them to stand up and not lean against the board and make eye contact and know the material well enough that they didn't stumble through their words and be able to answer questions about their project or their book report afterwards. Those are very early skills in rhetoric. Just practicing those early skills so that when they get to the formal rhetoric classes, those things they've done 100 times. So when I was thinking about what are essentials and non-essentials, I eventually arrived at some essentials that I think, and this is not a complete list, but I think in regard to content, method, and telos, or the end aim of a classical education, that in regards to content, a classical education must have or must do these things. And probably not limited to these things, but it must participate in the great conversation. They must read some, not all, of the great books of Western civilization. It must use primary sources and develop an appreciation for the historical context of ideas. It must teach habits, heart, mind, and body. It must teach in regard to a greater end than a subject's utility or its usefulness. And a classical education understands that it's integrated. It's an integrated, unified whole, not subject by subject. And then in regard to method in a classical education, the non-negotiables, it's dialectic, it's guided by questioning rather than just looking through the book and writing down answers. It's interactive and leads students to discovery, and it's gospel-centered. It's an understanding that God is calling fallen man back to himself. And then in regard to the telos, or the end aim of a classical education, I think the non-negotiables are it's in pursuit of the true, the good, and the beautiful. Its end aim is students living a virtuous life. It develops a moral imagination. It's teaching so as to form a soul rather than inform a brain or prepare a worker. And it's the cultivation of affections, teaching a student to love what he ought. The end question, I think, is who will you be, not what will you be when you grow up? And all this in content, method, and telos is accomplished through the study of these 7 liberal arts. So Hugh of St. Victor wrote, out of all of the sciences, the ancients in their studies especially selected 7 to be mastered by those who were educated. These 7 they considered so to excel all the rest in usefulness that anyone who had been thoroughly schooled in them might afterward come to knowledge of the others by his own inquiry and effort rather than by listening to a teacher. So thinking about those seven, then I really wanted to figure out how to mend these seven as opposed to just thinking about the three of the trivium. So how do we begin to mend the idea that we need seven? So we're going to think about musing on the muses. We're going to muse on the muses, or we're going to think, how would I teach like a muse? So in Plato's seven laws, or Plato's laws, it says, "Shall we begin then with the acknowledgement that education is first given through Apollo and the muses?" So first given, meaning the introduction of every subject, the basis of every subject learned, no matter what it was or when it was introduced, the foundational lessons in any subject they considered would be brought by the muses. Okay, so I know the muses aren't real, but in their lives, their muses were the deities of poetry and music and dance and history and astronomy. And they were the daughters of Zeus and the goddess of Mnemosyne, or the goddess' name was Mnemosyne, and that name means memory. So the root of the word muse has ties to the word mystery and mute or silent and myth or mythos, meaning story. That mu part of the word muse, which is seen in the word mute, had to do with things which are not or cannot be uttered plainly or directly, perhaps not at all. Not in the way that we say, ooh, I can't talk about that, but in a way that has to be described in some other way than by putting a list on the board. So it alluded to mysteries which silenced men as the muses expressed truth through song or poetry or story. The idea here was that great mystery is found in ordinary things, bringing wise men to silent attention and musing, watching a butterfly, hearing the thunder, seeing a birth, witnessing a death, illness, or love. Those things have to be brought by story, poetry, or song to be best understood. To muse means to think or meditate in silence or wondering. And the negation of the word muse, since it's a Greek word, you put that A in front of it, the negation is a muse. Isn't that exactly what we've done to education? We've traded our kids from musing to being amused. Kevin Clark and Ravi Jain have an excellent book called The Liberal Arts Tradition. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. But they say that education by the muses is a musical education. And they say, "A musical education was an education in wonder. It formed the heart and the moral imagination of the youth. A musical education was not primarily or exclusively about instruments and singing. It studied all the subjects inspired by the muses, from epic poetry to astronomy, in a pre-critical manner, and was directed toward joyful engagement with reality. They taught passions more than skills and content, and they sowed the seeds which would grow into a lifelong love of learning." The muses... Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, there's that quote. The muses were not lecturers who were moralizing the stories that they told. They weren't scientists who were teaching everything had to be tested. And they weren't rhetoricians who were persuading by their elegant words. They were mystery weavers who used their gifts to rouse wonder. Every subject was initiated by drawing a student in to the beauty and awe of the lesson. It trained students' imaginations to see the world anew. But we tend to skip that introduction by wonder because of time. And we say, I don't have time for this, or I have to get through this material, or maybe because we want to get straight to the things that we can assess objectively, probably because we don't understand that traditionally knowledge begins and ends in wonder. Dennis Quinn, in his article, Education by the Muses, says, wonder both begins and sustains education. The student who retains his sense of awe of nature never loses the sense of its mystery, and he never forgets his humanity. And what better subjects to think that bring a student to beauty and awe and wonder than the quadrivium? And you think, really? So let's talk about some of the methods for mending and musing. We'll start with arithmetic, because it's the first piece in the quadrivium. So arithmetic is from the Greek word that means number, and it teaches basic computation, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. That's arithmetic. So learning arithmetic has its greatest amount of formal instruction in the early grammar school years, and it's foundational to all other maths and sciences and music. The ancients didn't see the study of number and arithmetic the same way that we see them. And I thought this was brought home so well this morning in Abby's talk. She was talking about a poetic understanding or poetic knowledge. So the ancients understood that arithmetic was not only useful for calculation, it was also a divine science, almost religious or mystical. It was about eternal things. It was about beauty. It was the way to wisdom, to knowledge of the eternal patterns behind all things. You know, it seems to me that God speaks to us in several languages. He uses the written word and the spoken word, and in those he uses stories and parables and poetry and similes and biographies. And then he speaks in images of beauty and the mystery in nature. He speaks in music, even adding an entire book of the Bible to songs. He speaks through art as it represents the human condition and nature. And he speaks a numeric language. In fact, the most complex language he speaks is mathematical. Every language we learn can give us a greater understanding of who he is. So how can we approach arithmetic in the way of the Muses, pre-critically, so as to instill wonder? Well, one of the things that I found that I thought was really interesting, I'm not going to show this to you, although you can look it up, is just researching on the Fibonacci sequence of numbers, just how those are related and how they play out in nature and how they're found in our bodies and in all kinds of amazing ways. And another fascinating mathematical thing is just seeing the geometry in outer space, like how Earth and Venus revolve around the sun. So I'm going to show you just a real quick example of the geometry of the planets. Thank you. fascinating. That's just one of the examples in outer space that's going on. Now I started to understand why arithmetic was considered divine somehow, mystical somehow. So the question of arithmetic in the liberal arts, maybe it should be... Okay, I always get this wrong. I now have my Prezi all mixed up. Yep, then I have to start over, I think. Okay, here we go, maybe not. Oh, there's my lines. See, I have to find these little friends down here. Here we go. There we go. So the question, I think, for the quadrivium then, or the question of arithmetic, in the liberal arts, probably should be, what will an understanding of this do to me or do in me? Or what will I understand about God if I comprehend math? Not what will this ever get me or what will I ever use this for or how will I use this in my job, but how will I be more amazed by him if I know more about math? It's not a question of utility, but of learning a language that God speaks. What does God want to communicate to us through this language of math? You know, we do our students a disservice when we approach arithmetic in this worksheet, get it done kind of attitude, or we paste a verse across the top and call it Christian. We Jesus-ify it, as James K.A. Smith says, or when we begin with an abstract presentation before we learn the real things that it represents, we tend to willingly hand over delight for the sake of expediency or efficiency, and in doing so, we sacrifice the very thing that both starts and sustains education, wonder. One of the things that we've been working on at my school is becoming better math teachers, regardless of the curriculum that we use. We're trying to learn how to teach it conceptually rather than procedurally. And I have some recommendations on that resource list that you got. So, but as we think about math as a language, we know intuitively that language acquisition doesn't begin with the symbols of letters. So effective arithmetic instruction also shouldn't begin with abstract symbols. So if you are going to teach your kids how to bake cookies, what do? You set them on the counter next to you and you get dirty, right? They're mixing with you and pouring things in and they're spilling things and it takes way too long and you could have done it so much faster on your own. And by the end, you have cookies. What you wouldn't do is set them in front of a recipe and say, this is cookies. Memorize this and you'll have cookies. But that's what we tend to do with arithmetic. We set them in front of a recipe, a workbook page, and we say, this is arithmetic, and learn the process of arithmetic. But math should be seen and heard and touched and talked about and tried and failed and tried again. I have a few pictures of some of the things that we've done in class this year. Not that these are anything extravagant, but I didn't take very many because I wasn't thinking about taking pictures. But on this particular day, the third graders came in to me knowing some multiplication. They knew their 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, I think. But they knew it procedurally, but they could not represent it conceptually. So we had talked about what it meant, 2 times 3, 2 3 times, things like that. But I couldn't really, I could demonstrate it by making an array on the board, but on this day I gave them a piece of graph paper and I said, show me 2 times 3, or whatever it was. 3 times 5 maybe. And the kids who had memorized the, you know, the numbers just colored in a strip of 15. And so when I came by, I said, oh, I asked you to do 3 times 5. And they're like, it's 15. I know, but I want you to show me what is 3 5 times. It's 15. I know, but I want you to show me. And they couldn't get it. But the kids who didn't know it, oh, I see what she's saying. She wants this number 5 times, or she wants this number 3 times. So then I gave them one that maybe some of them weren't familiar with, 6 times 8. And these two little girls on the far end, they're probably my most timid math students. And one of them said, I don't know what 6 times 8 is. And the other one said, I don't either, but we're going to find out. So we were just demonstrating what it means, what arithmetic is. And this day, very similar activities, one of the same pages, and then a hundreds chart. And we were looking for prime numbers, basically. We were looking for numbers that couldn't be represented in more than one way without using one. And then they were filling in their hundreds chart to find the ones that couldn't be done that way. We were just like going to 20 or something. This one, and the kids are dressed like this because it was our county fair day, which had to do with Charlotte's Web and in conjunction with Valentine's Day. But they don't always look like this. But on this day, I had given them some pattern blocks, and I wanted them to show me a shape of some sort that had a line of symmetry. And so a lot of the kids just made a single line, and then they wanted to say, well, if I cut this line in half and folded it over, it would be symmetry. So I said, yeah, okay, that's fine. Let me show you one. And so I projected one on the board, and I said, imitate this, copy this, do this one, and then let's talk about the lines of symmetry in the shape. And then I gave them, you know, something else. I told them to mix it up and create a shape, round or square, whatever it was, with X number of lines of symmetry, or create something, and then you tell me what the lines of symmetry are. And this is equivalent fractions, just demonstrating equivalent fractions here. So math, for me, takes an enormous amount of time in my day, not because it takes a long time to do their worksheet, but because I front-load the lesson with activities. Always dry erase. I believe that every student should answer every question as much as possible. And then giving them something difficult just to think about. They sit in partners all day long, and I just present a question, pose a question to them, and ask them to work on it. Like, let's see, I have an example here. Like I might say, oh, took it off. No, I might say, this is one of the things that we did this year. We had multi-link cubes, and I just said, hey, I'm not sure if I could create a three-dimensional shape using so many numbers. Can you create a cube with an odd number of cubes? Can you create a cube that, things like that? Or just a math problem that's harder for them, but they would have the skills to pick it apart and do it. What's 22 times 8? Well, if they hadn't done that yet, they would have to figure out a way. So just things that are difficult and beyond them, but that they could work with a partner and think through. And then we talk about the answer and how they arrived at the answer and what did you get and can you tell me how you got that and, hey, that's fascinating, let's all try that method, those kind of things. So I try to give math the time it deserves and the enjoyment that it deserves. So the next thing that we're going to muse on is music, thinking about music in the classroom. But I don't think anyone would deny the power of music. It can change a mood, it can heal a relationship, it can reduce you to tears or bring you to cheers, it marks all of our occasions, it sells all sorts of products, it escalates love or hate, it draws us to God, and it sticks in our brains forever. The idea that this is Stratford Caldecott, says, the idea that the universe is creating unheard music and was put into place by the sound of God's voice is the essence of the Christian quadrivium. So I want to illustrate for you with another video clip just an example of what sound looks like geometrically. So this is use of a cymoscope. Have you ever heard of this before? So it's a little like a rubber plate with ultra pure water on it and then sound vibrations. And in this case, it's the piano notes that are being sounded. So this is the geometry of music. Doesn't that bring a new wonder to the reason why we Christians sing, or the power of God's spoken word, the power of His voice in creating? Consider what Plato said in the Republic. He said, there it is, musical training is a more potent instrument than any other, because rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul, on which they mightily fasten, imparting grace and making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful, or of him who is ill-educated ungraceful. And he goes on to say, for what should be the end of music if not the love of beauty? Musical training is a more potent instrument than any other. Even modern neurological research agrees with Plato. In recent brain imaging, researchers have been able to see the brain's response to music when it's either listened to or played with an instrument, and they found that all four lobes are firing when music is involved, where reading or math or something like that might spark a certain area of the brain. Music is in every area. In fact, they found that the brain actually picks music apart into pitch, timbre, and duration, and then puts it back together, reharmonizes it instantly so the brain can understand it. And then it's tied to the amygdala, which is the emotional center of the brain, and the frontal lobe, where planning and impulse control happens. And while that's happening, dopamine is rushing in, and that's what causes chills or for you to tear up. And then interestingly, they also found that there's a sudden blood flow increase to your legs, making it more likely for you to tap your foot or dance. And heart rate and respiratory rhythms are altered. Choirs that sing together often sync heartbeats. Maybe the most fascinating thing about music is how strongly it's tied to memory. Ah, the mother of the muses. So if you've not read or watched video of Alzheimer's patients becoming coherent after listening to music, put it on your to-do list. There's a reference for it on your page. Because memories are stored all over the brain, and music stimulates the entire brain, it's a likely stimulant for memories. Because music is this powerful and it seeps into every crevice of our brain and soul, we indeed, as Plato said, ought to pay attention, not only to guard, but to train our tastes towards beauty. It's another language that God speaks. And we want our students to be multilingual as we muses lay a foundation of wonder. Ken Myers says, if music really is the unique merging of spiritual and material, of temporal and eternal, of intellectual and emotional realities, if it is the perpetual activity of angels and the eternal destiny of the redeemed, then its capacities shouldn't suffer from neglect or carelessness or expediency or impatience. So how do we do this in the classroom? Well, you've heard others say this today. Start your day with singing. Start with a hymn. Last year we started with a hymn a month in all of our classrooms, same hymn. And then this year we do one review and one new, and those are our chapel hymns. So it gives the teacher a chance to talk through those hymns and explain that theology, even though they won't really get it. But it has changed the dynamic of our chapels. They are sweet now. Everybody, K-5 is what our elementary is, are singing those songs from memory and from their heart. Sing as a faculty. Have beautiful music playing in your classroom. So what about science? It seems a likely place to put science in the quadrivium. So muse and wonder and present it pre-critically. So, for example, before opening the book and studying the chapter on astronomy in the early grades, children should have spent evenings with their families outside looking up. They should have heard the myths of the constellations and the stories of great men who navigated by those very same stars. They should look through a telescope and see the surface of the moon. This was an activity with our third graders. One evening, we went out to one of the students' farm about 40 miles outside of town, laid out blankets, you can see there, and one of the dads brought two of his telescopes, this one and then a tabletop one, and the kids were able to see the surface of the moon and one of the planets, and then as it got dark, and we wrestled them in to be still and be quiet and sit on their blankets. Pretty soon, everyone was laying back and looking up at the stars, and the dad was just talking about the universe and the stars, and it was a fabulous way to talk about astronomy. Before labeling the parts of a flower, grow a flower, pick it apart, go on nature walks. And I mean, even in Kansas City, our nature walk meant walking the hedgerow around the chain link fence, around the property line, trying to avoid the poison ivy and the stickers, but you would have thought that it was something really special to be able to pick things up and bring them in and lay it on the back table. And that's not a picture of my tray. But my table was covered with stuff that they would find and bring in either from home or from our walks. I recommend the Beatles Project. It's on your list there, put out by the University of California. It's a discussion-based approach to nature, and it teaches kids to look at nature using these three statements: I wonder, I notice, and it reminds me of. So as we would go outside and find things, those are the discussion questions that we would begin with. Bring animals into your classroom. Have pets in your class. When I taught kindergarten, I had a class mouse. This year, I had a hermit crab. Boy, that was exciting. I've had fish. But I do think that the grammar school's approach to science shouldn't prioritize the scientific method, but it should be about slowing down and musing on the common things in their world as we lay a foundation in the love of learning. We're shaping their humanity, fellow muses, not filling a grade book. So when we began, I asked the question, is there such a thing as the quadrivium in the grammar school? Is the quadrivium important? Do we need it? Where does it fit in? So I think we would agree that we teach these subjects. So how do we teach them? Or are they for a higher purpose than what we have traditionally taught them for? So if the quadrivium is just four more subjects that are unrelated to our telos, to be learned later then I could see why we wouldn't give it precedence. But if instruction in the quadrivium is necessary, or if in the least it's helpful in drawing students to wonder and awe and admiration and delight of the Lord, then we dare not neglect our duty to teach them as the muses would. Thank you. Do you have questions or thoughts, comments? Tired? Yeah, you know, because of the other duty that I have as dean of faculty, I've watched a lot of teachers teach, and I think it's probably one of the most insecure places for an elementary teacher is in front of the math. So we've had to kind of dig. So on your resources, I recommended two things in particular. Or two people. One of them is Jo Bowler, and she's a professor at Stanford. She's written several books, Mathematical Mindset or Math, What's Math Got to Do with It. But on that website, U-Cubed, she has all kinds of material and online classes. So we had our faculty, our elementary faculty, work through a lot of those videos. And we dedicated multiple in-services just as a faculty for that. And then the K-2 teachers took a class online, and it's noted on there from Christina Tondewald or something. And then it's just something that every once in a while I just bring up in a faculty development. And some of it is just teaching teachers to explore a little bit, you know, just try this. But I really think they need some kind of training, you know, to say, oh, I haven't thought of it like that before. You know? Yeah. God bless you all. Have a safe trip home. Thank you. Or did you? Yeah, I did too, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought your name seemed familiar.
Yeah.
So, do you have children?
They're grown.
Okay.
Yeah. But we're in the first Kansas City up near North Kansas City Hospital.
Okay. Okay. Did you meet
No.
No.
Okay.
No. No.
That was like the rich
family. Oh. Well, there used to be an Oxford family that lived over there. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so tell me again.
Up by North Kansas Hospital. Right at like I-35 and I-29. Kind of in that was
Well,
no.
Oh, I-35 and I-29.
Farther south than that, quite a bit farther south than that. Right, I mean, the river is right where we are.
Okay.
We're just at the crook there, drive over the river into downtown campus.
Okay.
By North Town.
Okay.
Yeah.
We are at about 350 in my K-12. Mm-hmm. How about you, Marshall?
I'm at Marshall Academy in Cincinnati area.
Okay. So
the enrollment's similar.
Yeah.
K-12. Yeah.
How long have you been there?
He's like my first.
Oh, well, good for you for being here. Yeah, good. That's great, because now you've got
somewhere to start. You don't have to be, like, so lost.
Well, I'm drinking from a fire hose.
I bet you are.
Yeah. Great. Well, nice to meet you. I have a brother in Kansas City, so I'm going to know
And it's not like a practical application, it's direct application, so I didn't really